"It is," whispered the Count. Setting down his glass, he slipped between his jackets, opened the closet door, and stepped into his bedroom only to discover Andre and Emile at the foot of the bed in the midst of a hushed debate. Emile was holding a 10-layered cake in the shape of a piano, and Andre must have just suggested they leave it on the bed with a note, because Emile was replying that one does not dump a dobos tort on a bed cover, when the closet door opened and out popped the Count. Andre let out a gasp. The Count drew in a breath. Emile dropped the cake. And the evening might have come to an end right then and there, but for Andre's instinctive inability to let an object fall to the floor. With the lightest of steps and his fingers outstretched, the one-time juggler caught the tort in mid-air. As Andre breathed a sigh of relief and Emile stared with his mouth open, the Count attempted to act matter-of-factly.
"Why, Andre, Emile, what a pleasant surprise!"
Taking his cue from the Count, Andre acted as if nothing out of the ordinary had just happened. Emile made a little something for Sophia in anticipation of her victory, he said. "Please give her our heartfelt congratulations." Then, placing the cake gently on the Grand Duke's desk, Andre turned to the door. But Emile didn't budge.
"Alexander Ilyich," he demanded, "what in the name of Ivan were you doing in the closet?"
"In the closet?" asked the Count.
"Why, I was..."
His voice trailed off diminuendo. Andre offered a sympathetic smile and then made a little sweeping motion with his hands, as if to say, "The world is wide, and wondrous are the ways of men." But Emile furrowed his brow at Andre as if to say, "Nonsense!" The Count looked from one member of the triumvirate to the other.
"Where are my manners?" he said at last. "Sophia will be delighted to see you both. Please, come this way."
Then he gestured with a welcoming hand to the closet. Emile looked at the Count as if he'd lost his mind. But Andre, who could never hesitate before a well-mannered invitation, picked up the cake and took a step toward the closet door. Emile let out a grunt of exasperation.
"If we're going in," he said to Andre, "then you'd better watch out for the frosting on the sleeves."
So the maitre d' passed Emile the cake and carefully parted the Count's jackets with his delicate hands. Emerging on the other side, Andre's surprise at seeing the Count's study for the first time was immediately displaced by the sight of Sophia.
"Notre champion,"
he said, taking her by the arms and kissing her on both cheeks. For Emile, however, the surprise at seeing the Count's study was displaced by the even greater surprise of finding the film star, Anna Urbanova, standing inside it. For unbeknownst to the triumvirate, the chef had seen every single one of her movies, and generally from the second row. Noting Emile's star-struck expression, Andre took a quick step forward and put his hands under the cake. But Emile did not lose his grip this time. Rather, he suddenly thrust the cake toward Anna, as if he had baked it for her.
"Thank you so much," she said. "But isn't that for Sophia?"
Emile blushed from his shoulders to the top of his balding head and turned to Sophia.
"I made your favourite," he said. "Adobus tort with chocolate cream."
"Thank you, Uncle Emile."
"It is in the shape of a piano," he added.
As Emile produced his chopper from his apron string and proceeded to slice the cake, the Count took two more glasses from the ambassador and filled them with champagne. The story of Sophia's victory was told again, and the perfection of her performance was compared by Anna to the perfection of Emile's cake. As the chef began explaining to the actress the intricate process by which one makes such a tort, Andre was recalling for Sophia's benefit the night many years ago when he and several others had toasted the Count's arrival on the 6th floor.
"Do you remember, Alexander?"
"As if it were yesterday," replied the Count with a smile. "You did the honours with the brandy that night, my friend, and Marina was here along with Vasily."
As if by an act of magic, at the very instant the Count said Vasily's name, the concierge stepped through the closet door. In military fashion, he clicked his heels and greeted those assembled in rapid succession, without showing the slightest indication of surprise as to their whereabouts.
"Miss Urbanova, Sophia, Andre, Emil."
Then turning to the Count, he said, "Alexander Ilyich, may I have a word?" From the manner in which Vasily asked the question, it was clear that he wished to take the Count aside. But as the Count's study was but 100 foot square, they could only step about 3 feet away from the others in order to secure their privacy, an action that was immediately rendered inconsequential when the other 4 members of the party moved a similar distance in a similar direction.
"I wish to inform you," said Vasily, in a manner sort of entre nous, "that the hotel's manager is on his way."
It was the Count's turn to express surprise.
"On his way where?"
"On his way here,
or rather, there,"
said Vasily, pointing back toward the Count's bedroom.
"But for what possible reason?"
Vasily explained that as he was reviewing the next night's reservations, he happened to notice the bishop lingering in the lobby. When a few minutes later a rather petite gentleman wearing a brimmed hat approached the front desk and asked for the Count by name, the bishop introduced himself, indicated that he had been expecting the visitor, and offered to show him personally to the Count's room.
"When was this?"
"They were just entering the elevator when I took to the stairs. But they were accompanied by Mr. Harriman from Suite 215 and the Tarkovs from Room 426. Accounting for the stops at the 2nd and 4th floors, I suspect they should be here any second."
"Good God!"
The members of the party looked to one another.
"No one make a sound," said the Count.
Entering the closet, he closed the study door behind him. Then he opened the door to his bedroom a little more cautiously than he had the last time. Relieved to find the room empty, he shut the closet door, took up Sophia's copy of Fathers and Sons, sat in his desk chair, and tilted back on 2 legs just in time to hear the knock on the door.
"Who is it?"
called out the Count.
"It is Manager Leplevsky,"
called back the bishop. The Count let the front legs of his chair drop with a thump and opened the door to reveal the bishop and a stranger in the hall.
"I hope we are not disturbing you," said the bishop.
"Well, it is a rather unusual hour for paying a call."
"Of course," said the bishop with a smile. "But allow me to introduce you to Comrade Vronovsky. He was asking after you in the lobby, so I took the liberty of showing him the way, what with your room's remoteness." "How considerate of you," replied the Count.
When Vasily had noted that Comrade Vronovsky was petite, the Count had assumed the concierge was being colourful in his choice of adjectives. But in point of fact, the word small would not have been sufficiently diminutive to suggest Comrade Vronovsky's size. When the Count addressed the visitor, he had to resist the temptation of getting down on his haunches.
"How can I be of service to you, Mr. Vronovsky?" "I'm here in regards to your daughter," Vronovsky explained, taking his little hat from his head.
"Sophia?"
asked the Count.
"Yes, Sophia. I am the director of the Red October Youth Orchestra. Your daughter was recently brought to our attention as a gifted pianist. In fact, I had the pleasure of attending her performance tonight, which accounts for the lateness of my visit. But with the greatest pleasure, I come to confer upon her a position as our second pianist."
"The Youth Orchestra of Moscow?"
exclaimed the Count.
How wonderful! Where are you housed?
No, I'm sorry if I haven't been clear, explained Franofsky. The Red October Youth Orchestra is not in Moscow. It is in Stalingrad. After a moment of bewilderment, the Count attempted to compose himself.
As I said, it is a wonderful offer, Mr. Franofsky, but I am afraid that Sophia would not be interested.
Franofsky looked to the bishop as if he hadn't understood the Count's remark. The bishop simply shook his head.
But it is not a matter of interest, Franofsky said to the Count. A requisition has been made and an appointment has been granted by the Regional Undersecretary of Cultural Affairs.
The director took a letter from his jacket, handed it to the Count, and reached over to point to the Undersecretary's signature. As you can see, Sophia is to report to the orchestra on the 1st of September. With a feeling of nausea, the Count read over this letter that, in the most technical of language, welcomed his daughter to an orchestra in an industrial city 600 miles away.
"The Youth Orchestra of Stalingrad," the bishop said. "How exciting this must be for you, Alexander Ilyich."
Looking up from the letter, the Count saw the flash of spite in the bishop's smile, and just like that, the Count's feelings of nausea and bewilderment were gone, having been replaced by a cold fury. Standing to his full height, the Count took a step toward the bishop with every intention of grabbing him by the lapels, or better yet, the throat, when the door to the closet opened and Anna Urbanova stepped into the room. The Count, the bishop, and the petite musical director all looked up in surprise. Crossing gracefully to the Count's side and delicately placing her hand at the small of his back, Anna studied the expressions of the two men in the doorway, then addressed the bishop with a smile.
"Why, Manager Leblevsky, you look as if you've never seen a beautiful woman step from a closet before."
"I haven't," sputtered the bishop.
"Of course," she said sympathetically.
Then she turned her attention to the stranger.
"And who have we here?"
Before the bishop or the Count could reply, the little man piped up.
"Comrade Ivan Franofsky, director of the Red October Youth Orchestra of Stalingrad. It is an honor and a privilege to meet you, Comrade Urbanova."
"An honor and a privilege," echoed Anna with her most disarming smile. "You exaggerate, Comrade Franofsky, but I shan't hold it against you."
Comrade Franofsky returned the actress's smile with a blush.
"Here," she added, "let me help you with your hat."
For, as a matter of fact, the musical director had folded his hat 2 times over. Taking it from his hands, Anna gently restored the crown, snapped the brim, and returned the hat in a manner that would be retold by the director a few 100 times in the years to come.
"So, you are the musical director of the youth orchestra in Stalingrad?"
"I am," he said.
"Then perhaps you know Comrade Nechevko."
At the mention of the round-faced Minister of Culture, the director stood up so straight he added an inch to his stature.
"I have never had the honour." "Pantelimon is a delightful man," assured Anna, "and a great supporter of youthful artistry. In fact, he has taken a personal interest in Alexander's daughter, young Sophia."
"A personal interest?"
"Oh, yes. Why, just last night at dinner, he was telling me how exciting it will be to watch her talent develop. I sense he has great plans for her here in the capital."
"I wasn't aware." The director looked to the bishop with the expression of one who has been put in an uncomfortable position due to no fault of his own. Turning back to the Count, he delicately retrieved his letter. "If your daughter should ever be interested in performing in Stalingrad," he said, "I hope you will not hesitate to contact me."
Thank you, Comrade Vranovsky, said the Count. That's very gracious of you.
Looking from Anna to the Count and back again, Vranovsky said, I'm so sorry that we have inconvenienced you at such an unsuitable hour. Then he placed his hat on his head and hurried to the belfry with the bishop hot on his heels. When the Count had quietly closed the door, he turned to Anna, whose expression was unusually grave.
When did the Minister of Culture start taking a personal interest in Sophia?
He asked.
Tomorrow afternoon, she replied, at the latest.
If those gathered in the Count's study had good cause to celebrate before the bishop's visit, they had even more cause to do so after his departure. In fact, as the Count opened a bottle of brandy, Anna found an American jazz record that Richard had slipped among the classical recordings and cued it on the phonograph. In the minutes that followed, the brandy was poured liberally, Emile's cake was eaten in its entirety, the jazz record was played repeatedly, and each of the gentlemen had his turn scuffing the parquet with the ladies in attendance. When the last of the brandy was dispensed, Emile, who, given the hour, was nearly in a state of ecstasy, suggested they all head downstairs for another round, a little more dancing, and to bring the festivities to Viktor Stepanovich, who was still on the bandstand in the piazza. Emile's motion was immediately seconded and passed by a unanimous vote.
But before we go, said Sophia, who was a little flushed, I would like to make a toast to my guardian angel, my father, and my friend, Count Alexander Rostov, a man inclined to see the best in all of us.
Hear, hear!
And you needn't worry, Papa, Sophia continued, for no matter who comes knocking at our door, I have no intention of ever leaving the metropole.
After joining in a cheer, the members of the gathering emptied their glasses, stumbled through the closet, and exited into the hall. Opening the door to the belfry, the Count gave a slight bow and gestured for everyone to proceed. But just as the Count was about to follow the others into the stairwell, a woman in late middle age with a satchel on her shoulder and a kerchief in her hair stepped from the shadows at the end of the hall. Though the Count had never seen her before, it was clear from her demeanour that she had been waiting to speak with him alone.
Andre, the Count called into the belfry, I've forgotten something in the room. You all go ahead. I'll be down in a moment.
Only when the last sound of voices had receded down the stairs did the woman approach. In the light, the Count could see that she had an almost severe beauty about her, like one for whom there would be no half measures in matters of the heart.
I'm Katerina Litvinov, she said without a smile.
It took a moment for the Count to realize that this was none other than Mishka's Katerina, the poet from Kiev, whom he had lived with back in the 1920s.
Katerina Litvinov! How extraordinary!
To what do I owe? Is there somewhere we could talk?
Why, yes, of course.
The Count led Katerina into the bedroom and then, after a moment's hesitation, took her through the jackets into the study. Apparently he needn't have hesitated, for she looked around the room as one who had heard descriptions of it before, nodding lightly to herself as her gaze shifted from the bookcase to the coffee table to the ambassador. Taking her satchel from her shoulder, she suddenly appeared tired.
Here,
said the Count, offering a chair. She sat down, putting the satchel in her lap. Then, passing a hand over her head, she removed her kerchief, revealing light brown hair cut as short as a man's.
It's Mishka, isn't it?
The Count said after a moment.
Yes.
When?
A week ago today.
The Count nodded, as one who had been expecting the news for some time. He didn't ask Katerina how his old friend had died, and she didn't offer to tell him. It was plain enough that he had been betrayed by his times.
"Were you with him?" asked the Count.
"Yes."
"In Yarvas?"
"Yes." "I was under the impression that I lost my husband some time ago."
"I'm sorry. I didn't know."
"Do you have children?"
"No."
She said it curtly, as if in response to a foolish question. But then she continued more softly. "I received word from Mikhail in January. I went to him in Yarvas. We have been together these last 6 months." After a moment, she added, "He spoke of you often."
"He was a loyal friend," said the Count.
"He was a man of devotions," corrected Katerina. The Count had been about to remark on Mishka's propensity for getting into scrapes and his love of pacing, but she had just described his old friend better than he ever had. Mikhail Fyodorovich Mindich was a man of devotions. "And a fine poet," the Count added, almost to himself.
"One of two."
The Count looked to Katerina as if he didn't understand. Then he offered a wistful smile.
"I've never written a poem in my life," he said.
Now it was Katerina who didn't understand.
"What do you mean?
What about Where Is It Now?"
"It was Mishka who wrote that poem. In the south parlour at idle hour. In the summer of 1913.
As Katerina still looked confused, the Count elaborated.
"What with the revolt of 1905 and the repressions that followed, when we graduated it was still a dangerous time for writing poems of political impatience. Given Mishka's background, the Okhrana would have swept him up with a broom. So one night, after polishing off a particularly good bottle of Margaux, we decided to publish the poem under my name."
"But why yours?"
"What were they going to do to Count Alexander Rostov, member of the Jockey Club and godson of a councillor to the Tsar?"
The Count shook his head.
"The irony, of course, is that the life which ended up being saved was mine, not his. But for that poem, they would have shot me back in 1922.
Katerina, who had listened to this story intently, was suddenly holding back tears.
"Ah, but there you have him," she said.
They were both silent as she regained her composure.
"I want you to know," said the Count, "how much I appreciate your coming to tell me in person."
But Katerina dismissed his gratitude.
"I came at Mikhail's request. He asked me to bring you something."
From her satchel, she took out a rectangular package wrapped in plain brown paper and tied with twine. Taking the package in hand, the Count could tell from its weight that it was a book.
"It is his project," said the Count with a smile.
"Yes," she said. Then she added with pointed emphasis,
"He slaved over it."
The Count nodded to express his understanding and to assure Katerina that he did not take the bestowal lightly. Katerina looked once more around the room with a light shake of the head, as if it somehow exemplified the mystery of outcomes. Then she said that she should go. The Count rose to his feet with her, setting Mishka's project on the chair.
"Are you going back to Yarvas?"
he asked.
"No." "Will you be staying in Moscow?"
"No."
"Where, then?"
"Does it matter?" She turned to go.
"Katerina?"
"Yes?"
"Is there anything I can do for you?"
Katerina looked surprised at first by the Count's offer, then ready to dismiss it. But after a moment, she said,
"Remember him."
Then she went out the door. Returning to his chair, the Count sat in silence. After a few minutes, He took up Mishka's legacy, untied the twine, and folded back the paper. Inside there was a small volume bound in leather. Tooled into the cover was a simple geometric design, at the centre of which was the work's title, Bread and Salt. From the roughly cut pages and loose threads, one could tell that the binding was the work of a dedicated amateur. After running his hand over the surface of the cover, the Count opened the book to the title page. There, tucked in the seam, was the photograph that had been taken in 1912 at the Count's insistence, and much to Mishka's chagrin. On the left, the young Count stood with a top hat on his head, a glint in his eye, and moustaches that extended beyond the limits of his cheeks. While on the right stood Mishka, looking as if he were about to sprint from the frame. And yet, he had kept the picture all these years. With a sorrowful smile, the Count set the photograph down and then turned the title leaf to the first page of his old friend's book. All it contained was a single quotation in a slightly uneven typeset. "And to Adam," he said, "because you have listened to the voice of your wife, and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, you are dust, and to dust you shall return." Genesis 3:17-19. The Count turned to the second page, on which there was also one quotation. "And the tempter came and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread.' But he answered, 'It is written, Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God.'" Matthew 4:3-4. And then to the third. "And he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, 'This is my body which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me.'" Luke 22:19. As the Count continued turning slowly through the pages, he found himself laughing. For here was Mishka's project in a nutshell, a compendium of quotations from seminal texts arranged in chronological order, but in each of which the word bread had been capitalized and printed in bold. Beginning with the Bible, the citations proceeded right through the works of the Greeks and Romans onto the likes of Shakespeare, Milton, and Goethe. But particular tribute was paid to the golden age of Russian literature. "For the sake of propriety, Ivan Yakovlevich put his tail coat on over his undershirt and, settling at the table, poured out some salt, prepared two onions, took a knife in his hands, and, assuming a significant air, began cutting the bread. Having cut the loaf in two, he looked into the middle and, to his surprise, saw something white. Ivan Yakovlevich poked cautiously with his knife and felt with his finger. 'Firm,' he said to himself. 'What could it be?' He stuck in his fingers and pulled out a nose." The nose, Nikolai Gogol, 1836. "When a man isn't meant to live upon the earth, the sunshine doesn't warm him as it does others, and bread doesn't nourish him and make him strong. A Sportsman's Sketches, Ivan Turgenev, 1852. The past and the present merge together. He was dreaming he had reached the promised land flowing with milk and honey, where people ate bread they had not earned and went clothed in gold and silver." Oblomov, Ivan Goncharov, 1859.
"It's all nonsense," he said hopefully, "and there was nothing to be troubled about. Just some physical disorder. One glass of beer, a piece of dry bread, and see, in an instant the mind gets stronger, the thoughts clearer, the intentions firmer. Crime and Punishment. Fyodor Dostoevsky, 1866. I, the vile Lebedev, do not believe in the carts that deliver bread to mankind. For carts that deliver bread to all mankind, without any moral foundations for their action, may quite cold-bloodedly exclude a considerable part of mankind from enjoying what they deliver. The Idiot, Fyodor Dostoevsky, 1869. And do you know? Do you know that mankind can live without the Englishman? It can live without Germany. It can live only too well without the Russian man. It can live without science, without bread. And it only cannot live without beauty. Demons. Fyodor Dostoevsky, 1872. All this happened at the same time. A boy ran up to a pigeon and, smiling, looked at Levin. The pigeon flapped its wings and fluttered off, sparkling in the sun amidst the air trembling with snow dust, while the smell of baked bread wafted from the window as the rolls appeared in it. All this together was so extraordinarily good that Levin laughed and wept from joy. Anna Karenina, Leo Tolstoy, 1877. Do you see these stones in this bare, scorching desert? Turn them into bread, and mankind will run after you like sheep, grateful and obedient. But you did not want to deprive man of freedom, and rejected the offer. For what sort of freedom is it, you reasoned, if obedience is bought with loaves of bread? From the Grand Inquisitor. The Brothers Karamazov. Fyodor Dostoevsky, 1880.
As the Count turned the pages, he smiled in recognition of the characteristic feistiness that Mishka's project expressed. But following the quote from the Grand Inquisitor, there was a second citation from the Brothers Karamazov, from a scene the Count had all but forgotten. It related to the little boy Ilyushechka, the one who was hounded by his schoolmates until falling dangerously ill. When the boy finally dies, his heart-stricken father tells the saintly Alyosha Karamazov that his son had made one final request.
"Papa, when they put the dirt on my grave, crumble a crust of bread on it so the sparrows will come, and I'll hear that they've come and be glad that I'm not lying alone."
Upon reading this, Alexander Rostov finally broke down and wept. Certainly he wept for his friend, that generous yet temperamental soul who only briefly found his moment in time, and who, like this forlorn child, was disinclined to condemn the world for all its injustices. But, of course, the Count also wept for himself. For despite his friendships with Marina and Andrei and Emil, despite his love for Anna, despite Sophia, that extraordinary blessing that had struck him from the blue, when Mikhail Fyodorovich Mindich died, there went the last of those who had known him as a younger man. Though, as Katerina had so rightfully observed, at least he remained to remember. Taking a deep breath, the Count attempted to restore his composure, determined to read through the final pages of his old friend's final discourse. The progression of citations, which had spanned over 2,000 years, did not continue much further. For rather than extending into the present, the survey ended in June 1904, with the sentences that Mishka had cut from Chekhov's letter all those years ago.
"Here in Berlin,
We've taken a comfortable room in the best hotel. I'm very much enjoying the life here, and haven't eaten so well and with such an appetite in a long time. The bread here is amazing. I've been stuffing myself with it. The coffee is excellent. And the dinners are beyond words. People who have never been abroad don't know how good bread can be. Given the hardships of the 1930s, the Count supposed he could understand why Shalimov, or his superiors, had insisted upon this little bit of censorship. Having presumed that Chekhov's observation could only lead to feelings of discontent or ill will. But the irony, of course, was that Chekhov's observation was no longer even accurate. For surely, by now, the Russian people knew better than anyone in Europe how good a piece of bread could be. When the Count closed Mishka's book, he did not head straight downstairs to join the others. Instead, he remained in his study, lost in thought. Given the circumstances, an observer might understandably have drawn the conclusion that as the Count sat there, he was dwelling on memories of his old friend. But in fact, he was no longer thinking about Mishka. He was thinking about Katerina. In particular, he was thinking, with a sense of foreboding, that in the course of 20 years, this firefly, this pinwheel, this wonder of the world, had become a woman who, when asked where she was going, could answer without the slightest hesitation, "Does it matter?" Book 5. 1954. Applause and acclaim. "Paris?" or so asked André, in the manner of one who cannot quite believe what he has heard.
"Yes,"
said Emile.
"Paris? France?"
Emile furrowed his brow.
"Are you drunk? Have you been knocked on the head?"
"But how?"
asked the maitre d'. Emile sat back in his chair and nodded, for here was a question that was worthy of a man of intelligence. It is a well-known fact that of all the species on Earth, Homo sapiens is among the most adaptable. Settle a tribe of them in a desert, and they will wrap themselves in cotton, sleep in tents, and travel on the backs of camels. Settle them in the Arctic, and they will wrap themselves in sealskin, sleep in igloos, and travel by dog-drawn sled. And if you settle them in a Soviet climate? They will learn to make friendly conversation with strangers while waiting in line. They will learn to neatly stack their clothing in their half of the bureau drawer. And they will learn to draw imaginary buildings in their sketchbooks. That is, they will adapt. But certainly one aspect of adaptation for those Russians who had seen Paris before the revolution was the acceptance that they would never, ever see Paris again.
"Here he is now," said Emile as the Count came through the door. "Ask him yourself."
Having taken his seat, the Count confirmed that 6 months hence, on the 21st of June, Sophia would be in Paris, France. And when asked how this could possibly have come about, with a shrug the Count responded,
"Vox."
That is, the All-Union Society for Cultural Relations with Foreign Countries. It was now Emile's turn to express disbelief.
"Do we have cultural relations with foreign countries?"
"Apparently, we are now sending our artists all around the world. In April, we are sending the ballet to New York. In May, we are sending a dramatic ensemble to London. And in June, we are sending the orchestra of the Moscow Conservatory to Minsk, Prague, and Paris, where Sophia will be performing Rachmaninoff at the Palais Garnier."
"It's incredible," said André.
"Fantastical," said Emile.
"I know."
The three men laughed, until Emile pointed his chopper at his colleagues.
"But well deserved."
"Oh, absolutely."
"Without a doubt."
The three were quiet, each lost for a moment in their respective memories of the City of Light.
"Do you think it has changed?" wondered André.
"Yes," said Emile, "as much as the pyramids."
And here, the three members of the Triumvirate might have waded into the rose-coloured past, but for the fact that the door to Emile's office swung open and in walked the newest member of the Boyarsky's daily meeting, the bishop.
"Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm sorry to keep you waiting. There was business at the front desk that demanded my immediate attention. In the future, please don't feel the need to congregate until I have arrived."
Emile grunted, semi-audibly. Ignoring the chef, the bishop turned to the count.
"Head waiter Rostov, isn't this your day of rest? You shouldn't feel the need to be in attendance at the daily meeting when you are not scheduled to work."
"Well informed is well prepared," said the count.
"Of course."
Some years before, the bishop had helpfully explained to the count that while the Metropole's employees each had their narrow little tasks, the manager alone had to ensure a standard of excellence for the entire hotel. And to be fair, the bishop's personality made him perfectly suited to the task. For whether in the guest rooms, the lobby, or the linen closet on the second floor, no detail was too small, no floor too immaterial, no moment too inopportune to receive the benefit of the bishop's precious, persnickety, and mildly dismissive interference. And that was certainly the case within the walls of the Boyarsky. The daily meeting commenced with a detailed description of the evening's special offerings. Naturally, the bishop had dispensed with the tradition of tasting the specials, on the grounds that the chef knew perfectly well what his food tasted like, and to prepare samples for the staff was both indiscriminate and wasteful. Instead, Emile was instructed to write out a description of the specials by hand. With another grunt, the chef slid his menu across the table. After inscribing a series of circles, arrows, and X's, the bishop's pencil paused.
"I should think that beets would accompany the pork quite as well as apples," he reflected. "And if I am not mistaken, Chef Zhukovsky, you still have a bushel of beets in the pantry."
As the bishop inserted this improvement into Emile's menu, the chef cast a furious glance across the table at the man he now referred to as Count Blabbermouth. Handing the corrected menu back to the chef, the bishop now turned his attention to the maitre d', who slid the book across the table. Despite the fact that it was one of the last days of 1953, the bishop opened the book to the first page and turned through the weeks of the year, one by one. Finally arriving at the present, he scrutinized the evening's reservations with the tip of his pencil. Then he provided seating instructions to André and slid the book back. As a final piece of business, the bishop alerted the maitre d' to the fact that the flowers in the dining room centerpiece had begun to wilt.
"I noted that as well," said André. "But I am afraid our flower shop has not been carrying the inventory necessary to ensure a frequent refreshing of the arrangement."
"If you cannot secure flowers of sufficient freshness from florist Eisenberg, then perhaps it is time to switch to a silk arrangement. That would obviate the necessity for refreshing the arrangement and should have the added benefit of proving more economical."
"I shall speak with florist Eisenberg today," said André.
"Of course."
Once the bishop had concluded the meeting and Emile had gone off grumbling in search of his bushel of beets, the count accompanied André to the main staircase.
"A tout à l'heure,"
said the maitre d', as he headed down to the flower shop.
"A biento,"
said the count, as he headed up to his rooms. But as soon as André had disappeared from sight, the count was back on the second floor landing. Spying around the corner to confirm that his friend was gone, The Count hurried to the Boyarsky. Having locked the door behind him, he peeked into the kitchen to confirm that Emil and his staff were otherwise engaged. Only then did he approach the maitre d's podium, open the drawer, cross himself twice, and pull out the 1954 edition of the book. Within minutes, he had reviewed all the reservations in January and February. He paused at one event scheduled for the Yellow Room in March, and another scheduled for the Red Room in April, but neither would do. As he moved further into the future, the pages of the book became increasingly bare. Whole weeks passed without a single entry. The Count began flipping the pages with a quicker pace, and even a hint of desperation. That is, until he landed on the 11th of June. Having studied the marginal notes written in Andre's delicate script, the Count tapped the entry twice. A combined dinner of the Presidium and the Council of Ministers, two of the most powerful bodies in the Soviet Union. Returning the book to its drawer, the Count climbed the stairs to his bedroom, pushed his chair aside, sat on the floor, and for the first time in almost 30 years, opened one of the hidden doors in the legs of the Grand Duke's desk. For while the Count may have resolved to take action on the night of Katerina's visit 6 months before, it was only with news of the conservatory's goodwill tour that the clock had begun to tick. When the Count arrived at the Shalyapin at 6 o'clock that night, the denizens of the bar were celebrating the misadventures of Pudgy Webster, a gregarious, if somewhat hapless American who had recently arrived in the capital. 29 years old and still suffering from that affliction for which he had been nicknamed as a boy, Pudgy had been sent to Russia by his father, the owner of the American Vending Machine Company of Montclair, New Jersey, with strict instructions that he not come home until he had sold 1,000 machines. After 3 weeks, he had finally secured his first meeting with a party official, the assistant to the manager of the skating rink in Gorky Park, and had thus been convinced by several journalists to sponsor a round of champagne. Taking a stool at the other end of the bar, the Count accepted a flute from Odrius with a grateful nod and the smile of one who has his own cause for celebration. The designs of men are notoriously subservient to happenstance, hesitation, and haste. But had the Count been given the power to engineer an optimal course of events, he could not have done a better job than fate was doing on its own. So, with a smile on his lips, he raised his glass. But to toast fate is to tempt fate, and sure enough, even as the Count set his flute down on the bar, a gust of frozen air brushed against the nape of his neck, followed by an urgent whisper. "Your Excellency!" Turning on his stool, the Count was surprised to find Viktor Stepanovich standing behind him with frost on his shoulders and snow on his cap. A few months before, Viktor had joined a chamber orchestra and thus was rarely at the hotel in the evening. What's more, he was panting as if he had just sprinted across the city.
"Viktor!" exclaimed the Count. "What is it? You look in a state."
Viktor ignored the remark and began to speak with uncharacteristic impatience.
"I know that you are protective of your daughter, Your Excellency, and rightfully so. Such is the prerogative of any parent, and the duty of one who is raising a tender heart. But with all due respect, I think you are making a terrible mistake. She will be graduating in 6 months, and her chances of receiving a worthy position will only be hampered by your decision."
"Viktor," said the Count, rising from his stool,
"I have no idea what you are talking about."
Viktor studied the Count.
"You did not instruct Sophia to withdraw her name?"
"Withdraw her name from what?"
"I just received a call from Director Vavilov. He informed me that she has declined the invitation to travel with the Conservatory's orchestra."
"Declined the invitation?"
"I assure you, my friend, that I had no idea. In fact,
I agree with you hares, hounds, and horses that the brightness of her future depends upon her performing on that tour.
The two men looked at each other, dumbfounded.
She must have acted of her own accord, said the Count after a moment. But to what end?
He shook his head.
I fear it may be my fault, Victor. Yesterday afternoon, when we received the news, I made so much of it. The chance to play Rachmaninoff before an audience of thousands in the Palais Garnier. I must have triggered feelings of trepidation. She has a tender heart, as you say, but she also has spunk. She is bound to come around in the weeks ahead.
Victor took the Count by the sleeve.
But there are no weeks ahead. On Friday, a public announcement will be made describing the orchestra's itinerary and the musical program. The director will need to have all of his performers in place before the announcement. Assuming that the decision to withdraw Sophia was yours, I gained his assurance that he would wait 24 hours before making a new appointment, so that I could try to persuade you. If she has made this decision on her own, then you must speak to her tonight and change her mind. She must come to the defense of her own talent.
1 hour later, at table 10 of the Boyarsky, with menus perused and orders placed, Sophia looked to the Count expectantly, as it was his turn to play first in Zut. But, despite the fact that he had prepared a promising category, common uses for wax, the making of candles, the sealing of letters, the sculpting of maquettes, the polishing of parquet, the removal of hair, the shaping of moustaches. The Count opted instead to summon an untold story from the past.
"Have I ever told you about Ribbon Day at the Academy?"
he began.
"Yes," Sophia said. "You have."
Furrowing his brow, the Count reviewed all of the conversations that he had ever had with his daughter in chronological order, and could find no evidence of having told her the tale before.
"I may have mentioned something about Ribbon Day once or twice," he conceded, to be polite, "but I am quite sure that I have never told you this particular story. You see, as a boy, I had a certain aptitude for marksmanship. And one spring, when I was about your age, there was a ribbon day at the academy in which we were all chosen to compete in different events.
Weren't you closer to 13?
Was that?
Weren't you 13 when this happened?"
The Count's eyes went back and forth as he completed certain calculations. "Well, yes," he continued somewhat impatiently. "I suppose I was something like 13. The important point is that given my marksmanship, I was generally regarded throughout the school as the favourite in the archery competition, and I looked forward to the event with great anticipation. But the closer we got to Ribbon Day, the worse my marksmanship became. Well known for piercing grapes at 50 paces, I suddenly couldn't hit the hide of an elephant at 15 feet. Just the sight of my bow made my hand shake and my eyes water. Suddenly, I, a Rostov, found myself flirting with the notion of inventing an illness and checking into the infirmary."
"But you didn't."
"That's right, I didn't."
The Count took a sip of wine and paused for dramatic effect.
"At last, the dreaded day arrived. And with all the spectators assembled on the sporting fields, the time came for the archery event. Even as I faced the target, I could anticipate the humiliation that was sure to follow when, despite my reputation, my arrow would shoot wide of its mark. But as with trembling hands I drew back my bow, from the corner of my eye, I happened to see old Professor Tartakov trip over his walking stick and topple into a pile of manure. Well, the sight filled me with such joy that my fingers released the bow of their own accord.
and having sailed through the air, your arrow landed in the centre of the target.
Well, yes, that's right, the very centre. So perhaps I have told you this story before. But did you know that ever since that day, when I have been anxious about my aim, I have thought of old Professor Tartikoff tumbling into the manure and have reliably hit my mark?
The Count turned his hand in the air in a concluding flourish. Sophia smiled, but with a perplexed expression, as if she wasn't quite sure why the renowned marksman had chosen to relay this particular tale at this particular time. So the Count elaborated.
In life, it is the same for all of us. We are bound to face moments of trepidation, whether we venture onto the floor of the Senate, the field of athletics, or the stage of a concert hall.
Sophia stared at the Count for a moment, then let out a bright laugh.
The stage of a concert hall?
Yes,
said the Count, a little offended.
The stage of a concert hall.
Someone has told you about my conversation with Director Vavilov. The Count rearranged his fork and knife, which had somehow become misaligned.
I may have heard something from someone, he said noncommittally.
Papa, I am not afraid of performing with the orchestra before an audience.
Can you be so sure?
Positively.
You have never performed in a hall as large as the Palais Garnier.
I know.
And the French are notoriously exacting as an audience.
Sophia laughed again.
Well, if you're trying to set me at ease, you're not doing a very good job of it. But honestly, Papa, feelings of anxiety have nothing to do with my decision.
Then what?
I simply don't want to go. How could you not want to go?
Sophia looked down at the table and moved her own silver.
I like it here,
she said at last, gesturing to the room and, by extension, the hotel.
I like it here with you.
The Count studied his daughter. With her long black hair, fair skin, and dark blue eyes, she seemed serene beyond her years. And therein, perhaps, lay the problem. For if serenity should be a hallmark of maturity, then impetuousness should be a hallmark of youth.
I want to tell you a different story, he said. A story that I am sure you have never heard. It took place in this very hotel some 30 years ago, on a snowy night in December, much like this one.
And the Count went on to tell Sophia about the Christmas that he had celebrated with her mother in the piazza in 1922. He told her about Nina's hors d'oeuvre of ice creams, and her reluctance to sit in scholarly rows, and her argument that if one wished to broaden one's horizons, one would best be served by venturing beyond the horizon. The Count suddenly grew somber.
I fear I have done you a great disservice, Sophia. From the time you were a child, I have lured you into a life that is principally circumscribed by the four walls of this building. We all have. Marina, André, Emile, and I. We have ventured to make the hotel seem as wide and wonderful as the world, so that you would opt to spend more time in it with us. But your mother was perfectly right. One does not fulfill one's potential by listening to Scheherazade in a gilded hall, or by reading the Odyssey in one's den. One does so by setting forth into the vast unknown, just like Marco Polo when he travelled to China, or Columbus when he travelled to America.
Sophia nodded in understanding. The Count continued.
I have had countless reasons to be proud of you, and certainly one of the greatest was the night of the conservatory competition. But the moment I felt that pride was not when you and Anna brought home news of your victory. It was earlier in the evening,
when I watched you heading out the hotel's doors on your way to the hall. For what matters in life is not whether we receive a round of applause. What matters